From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Walter Hill tells us about directing action films. Hill directed 48 Hours, Streets of Fire, The Long Riders, and the new film Red Heat, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger and James Belushi. Also today, we enter the tortured, exhausted mind of comic Richard Lewis. Lewis is a regular on Late Night with David Letterman, and he has his own HBO special this weekend. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from Living Color, a group that regularly crosses the boundaries between white rock and black urban music. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the movie's latest look at the national pastime, Bull Durham. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Walter Hill directs action films. He directed 48 Hours, in which Eddie Murphy made his movie debut. In his western The Long Riders, Hill directed three sets of Hollywood brothers, the Carradines, the Keaches, and the Quaids. His film Streets of Fire was about a rock star kidnapped by sadistic bikers. Hill's movie The Warriors followed street gangs in New York. Pauline Kael called it a real movie maker's movie. Walter Hill has co-written, directed, and produced one of this summer's big releases. Red Heat, which opens this weekend, is an action comedy that stars Arnold Schwarzenegger and James Belushi. They play a Soviet cop and an American cop who team up in Chicago, tracking down a Soviet drug dealer who's about to make a big buy. Schwarzenegger's Soviet cop doesn't play by the American rules of justice. He doesn't even know them. In this scene, his gun has just been confiscated by the Chicago police chief, so Belushi offers one of his guns to Schwarzenegger.
All right, I owe you one, because you saved my life tonight. Here. Captain Danko, you are now the proud owner of the most powerful handgun in the world.
Soviet Butterin, 9.2 millimeter. This world's most powerful handgun.
Come on, everyone knows the Magnum 44 is a big boy in the black. Why do you think Dirty Harry uses it?
Who is Dirty Harry?
Walter Hill, welcome to Fresh Air. I wonder if you see your new movie as a companion film to 48 Hours in that the stars are two mismatched guys who are opposites, but they become partners.
Well, I suppose. I keep hearing that it's another version of 48 Hours. I don't know quite what to think about it. Somebody once said that film directors only know two or three stories anyway, and they just keep changing the clothes on the actors and do the same thing again. I suppose the way I think about the comparison is it seems to me that the movie's less like 48 Hours than several other movies have been in the last couple of years. And two, if somebody is going to do, shall we say, an informal remake of 48 Hours, then why the hell not me?
Right. I know that when you were writing the movie, you were thinking of Arnold Schwarzenegger for one of the leading roles. Now, it's interesting, it's only in the opening scene that you actually see his body, his muscles. The rest of the time, he's fully clothed, and your camera is really focusing on his face most of the time.
Well, I find Arnold's face really the most remarkable part about this guy. People always, you know, they talk about Arnold's muscles and his body, and it's certainly something and a major part of the iconography, but I don't think that's why Arnold is successful. It's his face. He just doesn't look like anybody else. He looks like some kind of throwback to a medieval warrior, the way you imagine the Greeks looked at the time of the Persian Wars or something. And with the face and with the eyes, he's got a fabulous ability to communicate that goes beyond countries and cultures. I mean, people just love to see him win. It's really a phenomenal capacity that he has. He's not an actor, and he doesn't think of himself that way. You know, as he puts it, you know, he's a star, and finally, stars are good actors are Lord knows rare, but the rarest thing in films are stars.
Who do you prefer working with as a director, stars or actors?
Well, I don't think you can really say. You'd have to know what. I'd have to know
who the specifics were. Okay.
Yeah, what the film was and who the actors were.
Some of the early scenes in your new movie, Red Heat, are set...
And some stars are actors, too, so, you know.
Right, right. Most of the early scenes in your new film, Red Heat, are set in Moscow. How did you get permission to film there?
Well, it was a bit complicated. About 6 months before we started shooting, I submitted a draft of the script to the Ministry of Culture, I think it was, and also Mosfilm. We never received a reply, which I understand is the Soviet way of saying no. They don't like to actually say no, and they like to let it drift off. So I'd rather thought that we'd never get in, and made plans to shoot the Moscow sequence in Budapest. And while in Budapest, towards the end of our film, literally met a guy in a bar, and he said, "You guys want to shoot in the Soviet Union?" And we said, "Well, yeah, as a matter of fact." And he said, I can fix that. Don't worry. He said, "It'll take a little money." And And he made a, it's a little complicated. He made an arrangement with a Hungarian television station. This fellow makes a living booking rock and roll acts through the Eastern Bloc, you know, English rock and Poland kind of thing. And he made a deal with a Hungarian television station who cut a deal with the Moscow Video Company that was state-run. And as part of their kind of commonwealth, I suppose you'd call it, arrangement, the Comic-Con, the television station arranged a shoot in Moscow, and we were their guests. So it really... We just penetrated the bureaucracy at a different level, I guess is the only way to look at it. And we got our permits. I mean, it wasn't a secret that we were there. And they read the script and made no comment on it one way or the other.
You know, in some ways, this is more of a glasnost than a Cold War film, in that the Americans and the Soviets have a common cause to put drug dealers behind bars. But Schwarzenegger and Belushi, who end up as partners in the movie and trying to track down this this Soviet drug dealer, they participate in a lot of Miranda bashing and, you know, break the hand of one of the prisoners and really disregard reading people their rights and so on. And I was wondering if it's the kind of thing that audiences tend to really cheer on, and I was wondering if that expressed your sentiment at all, or if you just see them as those kinds of cops.
Yeah, there's a couple of people have asked me that question. They seem enormously disappointed that a Russian police officer doesn't actually turn out to be a liberal Democrat, and I am faintly amused by that. The a lot of those scenes are comedic. I think that the intention was to bring this guy in and let him see certain American police procedures, given his own background in a kind of his not understanding American culture and American slang is used for comedic purposes. If you're asking, am I in favor of bashing people around a police station or knocking them out in bars, no, I'm against that.
Okay.
At a self-protective level, first of all, I suppose.
My guest is film director Walter Hill, and his new movie, Red Heat, stars Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jim Belushi. It opens this week, and his other films include 48 Hours, The Long Riders, and Streets of Fire. Now, Red Heat and 48 Hours both combine action and comedy. When you're trying to put those two forms together, is the trick to keep the comedy funny and the action, to keep the action serious, in other words?
Well, the trick with comedy is always to keep it funny.
Yes, but, true. It's a hard trick to do.
Yeah, and the audience tells you right away. Action sequences, I don't know that they're secrets. You kind of approach it at a craft level, I suppose, but the jeopardy has to be real, or else... Mm-hmm. There's no thrill to the audience. It's a funny way to make a living. I mean, action films, action directing, because you're dealing with a form, a genre where the ending is foretold. I mean, the audience knows how these films end, and therefore, I mean, Clint gets his man, and Arnold gets his man, and Charlie gets his man, and so that you have to approach it at a craft level of, given a foretold ending, how do you get there? And what moves do you make? I mean, it's like a dance, really, between you and the audience. You both know the steps, and but that doesn't mean there aren't good dancers and bad dancers. I mean, knowing the steps isn't everything about dancing.
Well, I think there's more emphasis in action films now on stunts than there was when you first started making movies. As an action director, do you have to keep up with that and participate in the one-upsmanship of, you know, outdoing the last action film and its stunts?
Well, I think they have been hyped up in the last 15 years. I don't think there's any question about that. I don't know that you have to top everything. The action in this film is not the kind of thing that nobody's ever seen before, or it's not the biggest action that I've ever done, or certainly there is in a movie that's out there now. It's really the question of, does the audience identify enough with the characters to get into their predicament? And the secret of action films isn't the action, it's the characters. I think that's not often perceived, especially, I suppose, with people that write about these things, because they tend not to like the kind of characters that are in action movies, and they tend not to like action heroes. They're not alienated, usually, and they're not conflicted. And to be alienated and conflicted is a rather more fashionable point of view these days.
Did you set out to make action films when you first started making movies?
Oh, yes, yeah. First film was about fist fighting during the Depression, prize fighting during the Depression. And actually, almost every film I've done has been an action film.
What do you love about action movies?
Well, I suppose they kind of keep me in touch with where I was when I was about 17. I always liked action films when I was a kid. I got into this business kind of by accident, and making a living in it has always been a surprise to me. And I really try to make the kind of films that I liked when I was young. And beyond that, I think it's a profession and a craft, and I tend not to really approach it theoretically.
You wrote the screenplay for Sam Peckinpah's film, The Getaway. Were you able to watch him direct, and did you understudy him in any way before directing yourself? You started off as a screenwriter, I should mention that to our listeners, before you started directing. Did you work with him?
I worked with Sam on the script for about 6 months, but when they were filming the picture, I was in England working on something else. So I wasn't really around when they were shooting the picture, but I visited Sam on several sets, and I wouldn't say that I understudied him or anything as formal as that, but...
What did you pick up from him?
What did I pick up from him? Well, he had a unbelievable commitment to his motion pictures. I mean, to a greater degree, I think, than anybody I've ever known. And I think probably more than anything else, he showed me how hard you really have to work and how much you have to give it.
Are action movies more difficult to learn how to direct because they're potentially dangerous scenes to shoot?
Well, you have to be careful because, sure, there's always the possibility of, when you're doing something dangerous, that somebody can be hurt. I don't know, directors, I think, have an instinct for the kind of thing they do. They do, hopefully, well. And as you make films, you improve your craft. I think I'm a much better director now than when I started 12, 13 years ago.
Your action, I think this is especially true in your earlier movies, like The Warriors, Streets of Fire. The action was very stylized.
Well, that was because we usually didn't have a story.
Are you kidding or serious when you say that?
No, I wish I was.
but they're really great looking. I mean, the streets are just almost neon-like in some of the shots. I mean, the colors, the kind of dark colors that you got in some of the outdoor shooting was...
Well,
really
I always
terrific.
Thought...
And, yeah.
I'm sorry, I just would say, I always thought you could push the things harder than people had been up to then, and I thought you could just, you know, get a little deeper into the, and create a beyond reality
yeah.
kind of feeling, and because so much of what you do in action films is rather fantastical, so I wanted to underline that a bit. And it seemed to work.
You also got a sense of toughness as almost an extension of style in something like The Warriors, where all the different gangs and the Warriors had their own kind of haircuts, their own kind of weapons, their own kind of jackets and clothes. And in Streets of Fire, too, I mean, everything was so stylish that toughness became a sense of style. Did you see it that way?
Well, that's a hard one. I mean, obviously, I guess I saw it that way since I did it that way, but The Warriors, I always saw as a fantasy. As a matter of fact, I wanted to, the studio didn't let me do it. I was going to put a card at the start of the film that said, sometime in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And they objected strongly and said, you know, that was trying to make it sound like Star Wars, which I didn't really think was the point, but... it's the old John Ford line, you know, I've had 1,000 fights with the studios and lost them all. So the picture was very much a fantasy retelling of the Xenophon story of his march to the sea. But I think what got everybody kind of excited, the film had a couple of things in it that I think were fairly disturbing to people. Number one, it started off with a call to anarchism, which was unanswered. And secondly, and I think most importantly, the film accepted the institution of gang and didn't challenge it. It didn't suggest that gangs were terrible or immoral or anything like that. It just simply said they exist.
Yeah, there were no parents in the movie.
Yeah, they exist within this framework, and mm-hmm. now here is the story. And I think that got a lot of people very disturbed.
Actually, in some theaters, there was, like, fighting in the theaters. There was fighting spilling out into the streets, and that raised the whole question about, you know, if action on the screen creates action in the real world. Did you end up seeing the movie in any of the theaters where there was a skirmish?
No, never did. I don't see my films after I finish with them. Once I ship them, there's nothing more I can do to them. So I think it's just, and I'm the hardest critic on these things. You know, I see all the missed opportunities and things I should have done. And someone once said that films are never completed, simply abandoned. And I think that's correct. You finally run out of time. So once I ship a film, I don't see it.
Okay, well, I want to talk with you more about your movies, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is film director and screenwriter Walter Hill. His new film, Red Heat, stars Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jim Belushi. His earlier films include 48 Hours, The Long Riders, and Streets of Fire. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Film director Walter Hill is my guest. I think you really use very intensified sound in your action sequences. When there's a gunshot, you sometimes hear that bullet whistling by. If there's a punch that connects, you really hear it resound. Are you conscious of doing that? Do you think that you intensify the way something looks by intensifying the way it sounds?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we work pretty hard on that during the dub, and I'll occasionally put a shot into the surrounds or juice up a certain punch. I mean, it's really very common. I think most directors now do things like that. I try not to overdo it. I think the mistake that quite often happens is when somebody makes all the gunshots loud or all the punches terrifically ferocious, and then it just dulls out. It's just they have equal emphasis, and quite often the projectionist just turns the sound down, and you don't get the effect. So it's really when you choose to give it a jolt is really the question.
There's a sequence toward the end of your film, The Long Riders, which is about the James Gang and several other of the outlaw gangs, the brother gangs. There's a shot where they're riding on their horses and everybody's getting shot at, and it's slow motion. And it's been a long time since I've seen this, but the horses kind of jump through, I think it's a window?
They go through a window, yeah.
Yeah, and all the glass shatters, and the whole scene's done in slow motion. People are getting hit by bullets. I thought it was very brave in a way to do that slow motion, because slow motion can A, be very corny and obvious, or B, end up looking like an homage to the end of Bonnie and Clyde. and I really wonder what...
You know, Peckinpah, you asked me about Sam.
Yeah.
I can remember, when I did The Long Riders, and occasionally I use slow motion, and there'll always be somebody that writes something about, he's like Sam Peckinpah here, he's using that kind of thing. And as a matter of fact, in The Long Riders, the slow motion is used in quite the opposite way that Sam did it. Sam always used it to heighten reality, and in The Long Riders, it's like a nightmare. It's like a slow motion car wreck or something like that, feeling when you're in a terrible car wreck, God forbid. But Sam, I well remember, because the slow motion technique now is almost always identified with Sam.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time I was working with him, people used to, they were constantly writing that he had copied Arthur Penn, and he used to get furious at this. I remember him shouting around the office. And we all know he had copied Kurosawa. It was quite inaccurate.
Have you ever written an action scene that was too hard to actually shoot?
I think, as a matter of fact, most of them, you're right, you have to modify the staging. You can't find the exact location to pull off the complex stuff, so that you modify them in some way based upon location. Sometimes by finding the location, though, that you could actually make the sequence, you can give it another bend and make it better than it is on the page.
Well,
but a good action sequence has an idea. You know, it's not stunts. The stunts must complement the idea. The idea of the bus chase at the end, I'm using idea probably in a rather shallow way, but at the end of Red Heat, is not that these are objects of pursuit and escape, but finally they become weapons in the duel between these two rather resourceful Soviets.
Well, let's talk about this bus duel at the end. Schwarzenegger and Belushi are in one bus, and this Soviet drug dealer is in another bus, and they are... It's not a chasing, it's more like a duel. Yeah, you're right. It starts off as a chase. I don't think I'm giving too much away to say that the buses eventually destruct. When you're dealing with a scene like that, do you have a limited number of takes that you can do? In other words, once the sequence ends and the things are destroyed, is that your
That's
final
it.
Take?
Yeah, you really hang it out there when you go out to do these things. Now, you only get one shot at, for instance, the finale of that. That's it. It either works the way you wanted it to, or you live with what happened. And in this case, it worked out about the way we thought. Oh, the one bus fell quite short of the mark, but the camera operators and the focus pullers were able to compensate. But it's not an exact science.
Would you like to ban car chases from action movies?
I hear that all the time. As a matter of fact, that's why I think I did this one at the end. No, I think car chases are terrific. I think critics are tired of car chases, you know, but they're tired of movies. Because that's how, you know, it's their job. And everybody has aspects of their job they're tired of, I suppose. And No, a car chase, if it's just a hackneyed, tired car chase, is no good. But if somebody's got some way to do something different and do it interesting and push it a little further and bend it in a direction that's interesting, it's quite legitimate.
I guess I asked it just because it seems like the car chase has gotten to be so predictable and so formulaic. I don't mean yours, but I mean in a lot of action films.
No,
there's a lot
of
formula action films out now.
Yeah, I think that analysis is correct, but I think the answer is not ban car chases. The answer is do better ones.
Mm-hmm. Your movie 48 Hours, I think, totally changed your career. You had been doing movies that, I guess they were pretty successful, but 48 Hours was a real smash in the movies and on home video. And that's raised you to a new level in the film world. Do you want to use that success to make very personal movies, or do you want to use that success to make the biggest movies that you can? And maybe those for you would be the most personal. I guess what I'm asking in a way is, once you've had one box office smash, there's pressure to have lots more
that. I'm happy to hear about this imminence that you're attributing to me. I see myself as an action director out of work currently, but...
Oh, really?
No, these things are expensive. If you work in Hollywood, part of the game is that the people that invest in these movies have the right to have... an expectation of a reasonable return. It seems to me that the trick is to work within the conventions of storytelling and make them as personal as you can. But if you're asking, would I rather go to Sweden or Poland and make motion pictures, the answer is no. I like making movies in Hollywood. I like the kinds of stories that Hollywood films tend to be, and I really can't imagine another way of approaching what I do. I think it's probably best for whatever talent I have.
One last question. When you were young, loving action films and going to see them all the time, did you ever turn your head at any movie because it was too violent for you? Is there anything that ever made you really flinch or turn away from the screen?
No, I don't think so. I can't remember, but they were much tamer in those days. I've seen things since I've been an adult that have made me flinch. Things are more graphic now than they were then. No question about it.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us. Thank you.
Sure.
My guest has been film director Walter Hill, and he directed 48 Hours, The Long Riders, Streets of Fire. His new film, Red Heat, opens this Friday. It stars Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jim Belushi. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Connie Brook. Her new book, The Predator's Ball, tells the story of how junk bonds and takeover mania changed Wall Street in the 80s. I hope you can join us.
Where did you learn to drive a bus, anyway?
Kiev, Yaromir.
Jesus, we're going down the wrong way street. Get over on the other side of the street.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides, publishers of Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Comic Richard Lewis doesn't have an easy life. He's a hypochondriac, he's always tired, and his girlfriend put armrests in their bed. Preparing his HBO special for this weekend has made him even more exhausted. Coming up, we talk with Richard Lewis. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Vivid, the new album from Living Color. Ken says the very fact that the band's versatile enough to draw from rock and funk keeps them off both types of stations. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Bull Durham. Kevin Costner plays a world-weary minor league ball player, and Susan Sarandon plays the local woman who each season takes one player under her wing and into her bed. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffen-Schmidt. The judge in the Iran-Contra case today denied a key defense motion to dismiss the case against Oliver North, John Poindexter, and two other defendants. And U.S. District Judge Gerhard Gesell strongly indicated that trials will be held for the four. Gesell rejected the defense argument that the prosecutor improperly used protected testimony by the defendants at last summer's congressional hearings on the Iran-Contra affair. The Federal Aviation Administration today announced a new rule designed to reduce the risk of mid-air collisions between small planes and commercial jets. Details from NPR's Wendy Kaufman.
The rule requires that many more small planes be equipped with an electronic device that transmits the plane's position and altitude to air traffic controllers. Without the device, known as a Mode C transponder, controllers can spot the position of a plane on their radar scope, but not the altitude. And without that, controllers cannot always warn a commercial jet of an impending collision with a small plane. Today's rule is designed to remedy that. Specifically, the rule will enlarge the area around the country's 27 busiest airports in which a Mode C transponder must be used. And the rule requires that all planes flying above 10,000 feet use the device. These provisions become effective July 1, 1989. Additional restrictions go into effect at the end of 1990. The final rule announced today is far less sweeping than the government's original proposal. And today, the nation's major carriers said they think the rule is better than none, but said the government should have done much more. This is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
More than 200 subpoenas have been served as part of the FBI probe into contract fraud at the Defense Department. Law enforcement officials say the grand jury subpoenas were served to get testimony and documents from military contractors and from individuals. The subpoenas are in addition to the nationwide searches of defense contractors conducted by FBI agents yesterday. The investigation centers on allegations that Defense Department procurement officials accepted payoffs from military contractors in exchange for confidential information about military contracts. As many as 15 defense contractors and 6 current or former Defense Department officials may be implicated. The Reagan administration today relaxed a key feature of economic sanctions against Panama. American companies and U.S. government agencies there will now be allowed to pass on to the Panamanian government Social Security taxes they collect from their employees. NPR's Tom Gelton has details from Panama City.
The loosening of the order against tax payments to the Panamanian government means the regime headed by General Manuel Antonio Noriega will start receiving as of today about $2 million a month from U.S. government agencies here, as well as an undetermined amount from U.S. private companies. $2 million is approximately the amount that the U.S. military, the Panama Canal Commission, and the U.S. Embassy have been withholding from employee paychecks each month as the employee contribution to the government's Social Security system. Until today, U.S. companies and government agencies here were prohibited from passing even the employee share of the Social Security tax onto the government because it was considered an indirect payment to the Noriega regime and therefore illegal. The additional income will be an enormous help to the cash-starved Panamanian government. The Reagan administration has been reluctant to allow the change, but was pressured to do so because Panamanian employees of U.S. companies and U.S. agencies here were in danger of losing their health benefits if the payments were not resumed. In Panama City, I'm Tom Gelton.
A federal judge in San Francisco has issued a preliminary injunction forbidding implementation of a random drug testing program until a case challenging the program can be tried. The judge barred the Reagan administration from beginning random drug testing of federal prison employees. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 37 points, closing at 2094.24. Declines outnumbered advances. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Living Color is a rock band with a vision. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of their debut album, Vivid.
It's a measure of the inherent racism of rock music discourse that the most immediately noteworthy observation I can make about Living Color is that this is a black rock band. That is to say, here are four black musicians making guitar-based hard rock music normally associated with white players. Living Color's music is influenced by the Rolling Stones as much as it is by Jimi Hendrix, by Led Zeppelin as much as by Sly and the Family Stone. At times, this leads the band to sound like little more than a variation on any number of other high decibel squawkers, as on this number, Funny Vibe. Even at its most superfluous, which I think that track is, Living Color is more interesting than other bands working in that genre, anyone from, say, Van Halen to Judas Priest. That's primarily because the band permits its music to reveal the influences of both black and white sources, just as the best rock music has always done. Living Color's lead guitarist is Vernon Reid, an accomplished player who spent a few years working with the avant-garde jazz drummer Ronald Shannon Jackson. Reid is also one of the founders of the Black Rock Coalition. The BRC is a group of musicians, writers, and music industry types who are dedicated to breaking down the stereotypes that keep black and white musicians separate and unequal on the record charts. With Living Color, Reid attempts to embody an ideal of what a rock band can be, one that plays for racially mixed audiences, that plays in a wide variety of styles, and whose lyrics deal with topical matters when the spirit moves them. All of these traits come together on Living Color's Open Letter to a Landlord.
Now you can tear a building down, but you can't erase a memory. These houses may look worn down, but they have a value you can't see.
There's a sense in which Living Color's crusade for the democratization of rock and roll is fairly hopeless. I've been at music industry gatherings where Vernon Reid has confronted rock radio executives about their racist programming policies, and he was met with blank stares, if not outright hostility. The sort of stations that have played hard rock only for more than a decade now are not about to let black musicians back onto their stations, whether it's Living Color or Stevie Wonder. Their attitude boils down to, what do you think this is, the 60s, freeform radio? And stations that play so-called black music aren't any more encouraging. Because Living Color doesn't play doctrinaire funk or rap or do Whitney Houston-style ballads, it's frozen out of there, too.
The glamour boys swear they are diva. The glamour boys have it all under control. Always dancing, always laughing. The glamour boys are playing the role. The glamour boys.
That's Glamour Boys, a Living Color song produced by Mick Jagger. Jagger is a fan of the band and would like to hear Living Color on the same stations that routinely play oldies by the Rolling Stones. Reviews of the Living Color album in the mainstream press have played up Jagger's role in getting the band signed to a major label, Epic Records. Vernon Reid has said, quote, "To whatever extent Jagger made it possible for us to get a record deal, we now have to prove ourselves on our own." To a large degree, that proof is obvious on this album.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He reviewed Living Color's debut album, Vivid.
The cult of personality. I know your anger, I know your dreams. I've been everything you wanna be. Oh, I'm the cult of personality. Like Mussolini and Kennedy. I'm the cult of personality. The cult of personality, the cult of personality.
This is Fresh Air. Comic Richard Lewis has problems. After years of therapy, he's still a neurotic hypochondriac. The good news is that his problems provide a constant source of fresh material. On stage, Lewis is hyper, in perpetual motion, pacing the stage, hunched over, always gesturing with his arms and pushing back his long black hair. Lewis played the comedy clubs for 10 years, but when he became known for his frequent appearances on the David Letterman show, he gave up the clubs for big concert dates. Lewis has a cable special called I'm Exhausted, premiering this Saturday on HBO. The show combines a nervous breakdown with a live performance in Chicago.
Thank you. I just, you're a great audience. I wish I could feel better about feeling good, quite frankly. I'm a hypochondriac. My grandparents, they lived in a place that made me so out of it in Florida. I think the condo was called Crestfawn. That was the name of it, you know. So I feel, you know, and they bought me little gifts. I mean, well, they were very negative. We had like a little depression fair in the backyard for my birthday, and we used to throw wooden hoops around. Prescription drugs was a big thing. And they had No Tomorrowland, which is sort of a big thing, and Pin the Blame on the Donkey was a major game in my house.
How did the I'm Exhausted show come about? Do you go around saying to friends all the time, oh, God, I'm exhausted?
I said that, actually, I think, to my mother moments after I was born. I just have always been exhausted for the fear that I wouldn't do enough work. That's a whole other area, isn't it? Now, I don't always go around saying I'm exhausted. I'm a good friend. If I went to a funeral, I wouldn't be insensitive and say, I'm exhausted. I had been exhausted prior to doing this special for HBO. But the problem was the special had to be done in about 2 weeks. That was like, this should have been an episode of Nova, you know. How a Jewish man with bad posture who searches for perfection is told by executives that, fine, but we have to have it delivered in 2 weeks. And, you know, we pulled it off, I think. I don't know. But I was exhausted doing it, and I think it shows. But in a positive, affectionate way.
When do you allow yourself to take some time off? Here's what I'm thinking of. I know I'm the kind of person who, in order to take a day off, I have to have something measurable, like a temperature. You know, like, right. If I have a fever, fine, you stay home. Are you like that? I mean, do you need to have something really tangible, a real tangible problem in order to actually get some rest?
I need, basically, I get rest after a breakup from a relationship. I usually then feel I reward myself. I usually go away for a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
Without sounding, you know, tongue-in-cheek here too much. I mean, I really put a lot into relationships, and when they don't pan out, I then take a rest. I also, when I get the flu, God forbid, but when I do, it's like everything stops. I pull the phones out of my house. I don't care. I have absolutely no responsibility to anyone. I don't go to surprise parties. I'm in the bed. I'm in the bed for as long as it takes. I just feel as nauseated as I am, it's the only time I really relax.
Did you enjoy being sick when you were a kid?
Well, I did because I usually wasn't, and but people did. It was like a hypochondriacal kabuki theater I put on for the family, and I had different makeups for different ailments, of course. The flu, I felt, was the dead giveaway. I mean, it was this kabuki, very white makeup, and it was almost a mask-like effect, and it was frightening. I was half a bison, half a Jewish man, and it was... I come down to breakfast knowing that my family would shriek and then have me stay home, and they normally did.
Are you a hypochondriac now?
Yes, sadly.
What are the diseases you most often think you're getting?
Well, I would say mostly, and not to make light of diseases because they're so horrific, and certainly the sexual stuff now is so frightening. I basically get worried when I see any kind of rash, even if the slightest rash. I feel it will eventually spread into just cover me like Elephant Man. And I run to every salve store. There's a lot of salve boutiques in Los Angeles, thank God. And I have a rash man in Beverly Hills who I like. But basically, it's rashes that scare me more than anything. And also, any kind of back pain, I always fear. And I always did as a kid, sadly. Whenever I got a sore throat, for example, I really felt... it would never go away. This was when I should have known then that psychotherapy was right around the corner.
Do you ever have audiences who are so well adjusted that they don't get your jokes about neuroses?
I don't like to consider any audience well adjusted. Seriously, I don't like to judge people, and I certainly wouldn't judge people in that light. I don't find too many people are well-adjusted, and if there were, I wouldn't go over very well. If I ever bomb, thank God I don't bomb as much as you do when you start out, I would just blame myself.
You've done the David Letterman show a lot of times. How many times do you keep count?
I thought it was somewhere in the high 30s, you know.
Do you prepare for it when you go on?
In unbelievable fashion. It's the only reason why I have done stand-up in the last 6 years, or have given me impetus to do it, and because I never had an audience before, like on a regular basis. So I write down thousands and thousands of jokes a month. It takes me days and days to whittle it down to 30 or 40 ideas that I want to get to the show. Not to mention we ad-lib a lot on the show too, but I prepare in an enormous fashion for the show.
And I feel I had a problem sexually. I felt, ever since I grew up, and we broke up, she was saying that she's bad-mouthing me to my pals.
Oh, is that
she
right?
Said, I gave her an anti-climax, she was telling my friends. And I couldn't even...
That
I couldn't,
could be dangerous,
we couldn't even have
it?
Foreplay. She wore like a Rupix bra when she came into the bedroom. And I blame my family. My parents, I know they made love, and yet it was like Nixon, like Watergate. They would cover it up.
Very, very, quiet
well, they,
about
they
it.
They
yeah.
didn't want to let us hear sure. that they were screaming. Yeah. My father would go, that's gin. He would say that's gin.
Doesn't Letterman strike you as a pretty healthy, well-adjusted guy?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. Again, I hate to judge people's good health. I'll say this. I think so. I mean, he was such night and day together. I mean, why I think the chemistry has been effective for him and me. When I sit next to him, and I talk about my innermost feelings, and certainly sexuality. I look in his face. He's only a foot away from me, and it makes me laugh because I'm not doing this to make him embarrassed, but he does get, I feel, legitimately embarrassed, and it's cute to me. But his eyes start to recede; they go back like to the Panama Canal. I can't even see his face. It's like a little off in Annie's eyes.
Can I ask you what your bar mitzvah was like? And here's why I ask it: a bar mitzvah is. In Jewish terms, it's a religious ceremony to mark the beginning of manhood. It's just, but for a lot of people, it's like their first opening act, you know, like their first initiation into show business. Because like you're the star of the show. There's a band. There's an MC. You know, everybody in your family gets to dance and everything. And you're the star. Was it like a what kind of bar mitzvah did you have?
Spielberg could not have done justice to what I had. First of all, my father, who has passed on. was the greatest caterer in the area, New Jersey and in parts of New York. He was really a genius. So, of course, he catered my bar mitzvah. It got off on a low self-esteem note that my father was booked up on the weekend for my bar mitzvah. I had to settle for a Tuesday afternoon.
Are you kidding?
Early evening bar mitzvah party. Unheralded in the Torah. I mean, I heard Moses grumbling, well, how can he do that to his son, Ra? But what happened was, I understood, you know, he had a job to do, and Tuesday night was sort of hip, now that I think of it. But before the party, the Saturday before, I had to read what they call the Haftorah, or Haftorah, I'm very bad with the accents here. But what happened was that I started screwing up a little bit, and I saw some of the congregation getting a little uneasy, and then I started doing stand-up. I went, oh, I'm kidding, Jonah and the Whale, come on. And I started playing the temple like a lounge.
I mean, I don't mind being with the family on Hanukkah, because being on the road, like I was in the Deep South about 2 years ago on Hanukkah, they thought Hanukkah was a duck call. That's all I know. It was like, Hanukkah, pull, shoot. That's all, you know. I tiptoed around the Deep South on Hanukkah. I just want a sandwich. I'll be fine. Just let me have a sandwich. But Hanukkah, Christmas, we didn't know what we were, quite frankly. It was sort of a... I really don't know what we were. We had like a... There was a Christmas tree, and yet it was a Hanukkah bush. It was sort of like a... Sort of like an elephant man kind of thing there. It was like... They had balls hanging down, and yet there was like a picture of gold in my ear sort of over here. It wasn't Hanukkah. It wasn't Christmas. It was Chronica. We had Chronica.
Comedian Richard Lewis. His comedy special, I'm Exhausted, premieres on HBO this Saturday. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What you got for us?
Well, we'll have a report tonight on the Pentagon procurement scandal. We had a report last night on that, and Nina Totenberg will continue with the story tonight, talking about 200 subpoenas that have been issued nationwide in the investigation. Also, it's the last day of the International AIDS Conference in Stockholm. We'll have a report on what experts are saying about treating AIDS in heterosexuals, and essentially they're saying that AIDS should be treated in the same way that other sexually transmitted diseases have been over the years. A report tonight on Arthur Ken Kesey's class. He's the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and he's now getting a whole group of students to write a novel.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Bull Durham is a new movie about baseball and love. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Sports movies are a real oddity. They always work, but they're never much good. They always work because practically every sport this side of curling has a kinetic beauty that the big screen only magnifies. They also work because every game is a plot in itself. For many of the same reasons, though, sports movies are rarely very probing or ambitious, which is why the new baseball comedy Bull Durham is such a wonderful surprise. It's not about who captures the pennant, nor is it about how a team of woebegone stragglers finds the heart to win. It's about the funny poignancy of life in the minor leagues, about how it feels to be smart enough to know what greatness requires and to know that you don't have it. And the writer-director Ron Shelton, who used to play in the minors, conveys the camaraderie that holds small-town teams together in a way that's sometimes breathtakingly lovely, or funny, as in this scene in which the whole infield gathers at the mound for one of those mysterious conferences ball teams sometimes have in the middle of a game.
Excuse me, what the hell's going on out here?
Well, Nuke's scared because his eyelids are jammed and his old man's here. We need a live, rooster? We need a live rooster to take the curse off Jose's glove, and nobody seems to know what to get Millie or Jimmy for their wedding present. Is that about right?
That's right.
We're dealing with a lot of stuff.
Okay, well, candlesticks always make a nice gift, and maybe you can find out where she's registered, maybe a place setting or maybe a silverware pattern. Okay, let's get to it. Here we go.
The movie's hero, Crash Davis, played by Kevin Costner, is a hard-hitting catcher who reminds me of Jake Barnes in Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises. He knows the fates have passed him by, and he also knows he's a better man than many on whom those same fates will smile. And now he's competing for the love of a singular woman with a volatile youngster, a kid who's undisciplined, unsmart, and unlikable, and whose explosive talent will transport him to superstardom. As the kid, lanky Tim Robbins makes his character at once obnoxious and strangely endearing. And as the movie's mystery woman, Susan Sarandon gives the performance of her career. Her Annie Savoy picks one ball player every summer whom she will nurture and sleep with and turn into an even better ball player. That may sound like a simple male fantasy, but the characterization is richer than that.
You got him breathing out of the wrong damn eyelid. You got him parading around a locker room like a fruit.
That is a religious ritual, and it happens to be working, if you don't mind my saying.
Wait, who dresses you?
What?
Who dresses you? I mean, do you think this is a little excessive for the Carolina League?
The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom, William Blake.
What, William Blake?
William Blake.
What, William Blake?
William Blake!
What do you mean, William Blake?
I mean, William Blake!
And though Annie worships baseball players, she's also smarter and livelier and more knowledgeable than anyone else on screen. In short, Shelton has come up with a male fever dream that a diehard feminist can love as well. The hyper-literary screenplay pops with the sort of dialogue actors would kill for, and even sleepy Kevin Costner awakens for the occasion. This movie turns baseball into what it really is for those who follow it avidly every summer. It's not just home runs and big games. It's deep-dish comedy and drama. It's the poetry of the body and the freaky zen of performance. Above all, baseball is character study. And in conveying all that at once, Ron Shelton has come up with the best American movie so far this year.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent for West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with cartographer Stuart Allen. He says he makes maps so he can deal with truth and beauty. Also, Ken Tucker will review a new series of home videos that solve the problem of reading subtitled foreign films. And three musicians from the Cajun dance band Beau Soleil will return for our weekly performance spot. So I hope you can join us. We'd love to hear from you. Write us. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.